On This Week in Enterprise Tech, Mr. Brian Chee, Mr. Curtis Franklin join me here today. Black Hat ransomware groups evolve their tools. Security professionals look to do standards from a Bloomberg terminal-like single pane of glass for security. And Deputy CTO of Indicio, Sam Curran, takes us on a journey of decentralized identities. You definitely shouldn't miss it. Quiet on the set.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWIT.
This is TWIT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 513, recorded September 30th, 2022. A ledger never lies. This episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Cisco, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. When you need to get more out of your technology, Cisco makes hybrid work possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Cisco. And by Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to the simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. Welcome to TWIT, This Week in Enterprise Tech, the show that is dedicated to you, the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and that geek who just wants to know how this world's connected. I'm your host, Louis Maresca, your guide through this big world of the enterprise. But I definitely can't guide you by myself. I need to bring in the professionals and the experts and also add in their true survivors as well, our Orlando residents, starting with the very own Mr. Brian Chee, net architect at Sky Fiber, network expert, security professional, plus all-around tech geek. Chiebert, I was glued to my video streams the last several days, seeing the impact of Ian. How are you doing? How are you making out?
We're fine. All the years of preparing, living in Hawaii, hurricanes happen. You know, it's a force of nature. So we knew what to do. We've actually started prepping since middle of May so that we don't break the bank. We can slowly stock up. And once hurricane season is over, we'll just eat through our hurricane stock. And that way, nothing's wasted. So,
How did the power wall stay up? Did it stay working well?
Oh, the power wall was awesome. I'll actually talk about that in my blip. But the reality is once the grid went out, we started reducing the power load of the house. I managed to get everything shut off and got it down to half a kilowatt load. And at that kind of load, we were in excess of 24 hours of battery. And then once the sun came out, even though it was still very cloudy, it still managed to top it off. So we stayed at 24 plus hours of battery throughout the entire storm, which is very cool.
It's unbelievable. Thank you for being here, Chiebert. I know it's been kind of a journey last week. We also have to bring in a man of many talents, including having the pulse of security enterprise world. He is the very own Mr. Curtis Franklin, senior analyst at Omdia. Curtis, how are you guys holding up? How's everything with you?
Well, on our end of the block, we had a little more of the water, about the same amount of wind. And since I don't have the Tesla Powerwall, we have the next best thing, a neighbor with a whole house generator. So we made sure that things were buttoned up and went over to our good friend's house where we spent the day being entertained by things like art and reading and functional air conditioning. So it worked out well. We have to say that up here in our part of Orlando, things could have been much worse. Our neighborhood had no significant property damage. And no injuries at all. We're thinking about all those folks down in Southwest Florida who have a major rebuilding task ahead of them, and I fear that the death toll is going to rise. So this was a serious hurricane. It brought damage all up and down the peninsula. So it was a good reminder that taking preparation and warnings seriously is absolutely the right thing to do, whether you're in hurricane mode or computer security mode. It's a good reminder of where we can be.
Agreed. Well, I'm so glad you guys could be here. I really appreciate it. Well, speaking of being prepared, I think we have talked a little bit about enterprise security this week and lots going on in the news there. So we should get started. And as IT and security professionals strive for that single pane of glass to have a really good view into the health and security of your organization, imagine if you could have what traders and investment bankers have today. That's right, with their amazing Bloomberg terminal that gives you the view of the entire universe potentially related to your security and health and your network services. Wouldn't that be nice? Well, we're going to get to just how that could be in your near future and maybe even a standard in there a little bit as well. Plus, today we want to talk a little bit about verifiable credentials and identity space and the work to ensure decentralized identities as a big effort of the Insidio company. And today we have Sam Curran. He's deputy CDO of Insidio, and he's going to talk a little bit about just how you can actually move to a digital identity system that's more centralized, that's more closely related to physical identity credentials of today. So we'll talk about that. Lots of exciting stuff, so definitely stick around. But before we do, let's go ahead and jump into this week's news blips. Malware and ransomware crews are constantly evolving in their bag of tricks to ensure they fly under the radar when they're infiltrating organizations. According to this, the Hacker News article, the Black Cat ransomware crew is no exception here. They have been spotted in the wild, fine-tuning and evolving their malware arsenal to be undetectable in today's standards. Now, to highlight what they're actually doing here, let's talk about one of their tools called Info. Now, there are reports of a new version of this tool, which is an info-stealing malware. It is designed to steal credentials stored by Veeam backup software. It now has better capabilities to facilitate privilege escalation and lateral movements. The Black Hat is also known by the names of Alf-V or Noberis, attributed to adversaries tracked as Core ID, but also rebranded successors of DarkSide and Black Matter. So both of those were thought to have shut down shop after high-profile attacks like the Colonial Pipeline. Now, as you can see, security by obscurity and confusion is the name of the game here, including their names. The group is notorious for running ransomware as a service operations. Core developers enlist the help of or affiliates to carry out the attacks in exchange for a cut of the proceeds. Alfie is also known for some of the first ransomware strains developed in the Rust language, later to be adopted by other groups like Hive and Luna. Then that means their malware is cross-platform and can even impact machines that run Linux and Macs. Now, the evolution of the group's tactics, tools, and procedures comes more than 3 months after the cybercrime gang was discovered exploiting unpatched Microsoft Exchange servers as a conduit to deploy ransomware. Now, subsequent updates to its toolset have incorporated new encryption functionalities that enable the malware to reboot compromised Windows machines in safe mode to bypass security protections. Its continuous development also underlines the focus of the group on data theft and extortion, the importance of the element of attacks to ransomware actors now. Now, what's also very concerning is there's also reports of groups like these being infiltrated themselves. That's right. The groups themselves are infiltrated, and they're exposing their tools to less experienced people who fork them and make them their own and do bad things with them. Now, it's part of the black market many people aren't aware of. And what this means is that more and more of you should be working with your organization to better understand the effect and standard approaches to protect yourself from ransomware attacks.
According to an article published today at Dark Reading, businesses should be on the lookout for attacks targeting on-premises versions of Microsoft Exchange servers 2013, 2016, and 2019 that face the internet. This is according to a Microsoft statement confirming two Exchange Server zero-day vulnerabilities reported overnight. Microsoft said in an update today that it's already seeing, quote, limited targeted attacks, end quote, chaining the bugs together for an initial access and takeover of email systems. While Microsoft said that users of hybrid servers with OWA or Outlook web access were not affected by the vulnerabilities, security researcher Kevin Beaumont has said, and the security team at Rapid7 has confirmed, that the vulnerabilities do affect the web platform. Authenticated access to the Exchange server is necessary for exploitation, according to Microsoft. Beaumont clarified, quote, please note exploitation needs valid non-admin credentials for any email user, end quote. Now, the vulnerabilities are cataloged as CVE 2022-41040, a server-side request forgery vulnerability giving access to any mailbox in Exchange, and CVE 2022-41082, which allows authenticated remote code execution when PowerShell is accessed by the attacker. At this time, there is no patch for their vulnerabilities, though it's known that Microsoft is fast-tracking fixes since attacks are being seen in the wild. Microsoft has presented mitigations, including a blocking rule and a URL rewrite instruction for their vulnerabilities. Organizations running the affected email servers are urged to visit Microsoft's website for more details on these mitigations. Now, it's worth noting that the vulnerabilities were first disclosed by security firm GTSG, which is a firm out of Vietnam. The company said that it disclosed the vulnerabilities, which it described as being very similar to the proxy shell family of Exchange server vulnerabilities, to Microsoft last month, an act that would normally start the 120-day countdown of responsible disclosure. GTSG said that it only violated the responsible disclosure protocol when it saw active attacks in the wild. Now, Beaumont has dubbed these vulnerabilities proxy not shell and given them their own logo, while cautioning that the most secure action for organizations with vulnerable products is to stop using them until patches are available. He noted that successful exploitation would put an attacker in God mode within the server, a situation that would be the very definition of a very bad, no good, awful day for the victim.
Well, this is not an article. This is just me ranting. So warning, rant on. One thing was very apparent in the days leading up to Hurricane Ian's landfall. Human nature was at work. With crowds looking for last-minute storm supplies, people getting angry at others for hoarding bottled water or other supplies, and in general doing storm prep at the last minute. Well, my wife and I grew up in the most isolated set of islands on Earth, Hawaii. And with just over 95% of all bulk goods brought in by ship, any whiff of a major storm, dock strike, or anything else that could disrupt shipping would cause huge runs on supplies. The management of Costco were absolutely shocked at how fast their stock disappeared when they experienced their first dock strike rumor. They actually got wiped out 100% of their stock within 3 days. Florida, unlike Hawaii, can truck in a lot of goods, and like Hawaii, anti-gouging laws do exist to prevent things like $50 cases of bottled water. So what I did was start stocking up in May in gradual preparation for the June start of hurricane season. We also spent the money on ballistic nylon storm shutters. That's picture number one. The idea of these storm shutters is they are similar to bulletproof vests. It's aramid yarn woven together very tightly and bolted into place. Well, our big mistake in slide number two is our contractor did a really, really bad job of measuring, and Kurt and I actually had to use zip ties to secure the shutters. We were not pleased. Well, I also spent the money on a standing seam metal roof with solar panels clipped to the seam so that we had zero holes in the roof. Additionally, we dug down deep into our pockets for a pair of Tesla power walls. That's going to be picture number three. Oops, wrong one, sorry. Solar plant, picture number four. The cool thing about that third picture was that the Tesla Powerwall allows me to track my power usage. We actually managed to start turning a lot of stuff off and got our total house power consumption down to half a kilowatt. And at that level, we were actually able to have 24 plus hours of battery life. And then once a little bit of sun came out, we were able to top off the batteries. So life is good. Now, one of the things that did happen that was interesting was that the fiber internet that we had, which is AT&T's absolute latest and greatest fiber internet option, is based on what's called XPON. So we've actually talked about this in the past. The older standard is called GPON, which stands for gigabit. It allows you to take a single strand of fiber stretching from the central office out as much as 40 kilometers. And every time you drop it off for a customer, you put a splitter in there. It just peels off a little bit of light, and a single strand goes to the customer into a SFP plus, XPON optics, and allows you to drop off, in my case, 1 gig, but this particular one can actually drop off as much as 5 gig. Now, just across town at a slightly older installation, a friend had the original 1 gig maximum AT&T fiber, and that actually went out very early on in the storm. We think because that central office is based in an old bunker of some sort that it got flooded early on during the height of the storm, and we'll see. We'll see. I'm actually trying to query some people through the AT&T system whether or not that was the trick. Now, the last word. Folks, if you are doing hurricane prep and you have a gas generator, you should be starting and running it at least once a quarter. Otherwise, like my neighbor, you'll have a carburetor gummed up with shellac. If your gas sits in the tank for long enough, it turns to shellac. And it'll coat and stick everything, and basically you're going to have to get a small engine repair shop to tear apart the carburetor, and for about $300, clean it up and give you back a functional generator. If you are going to buy a new generator, think dual fuel, because propane does not have that issue. And the nice thing about dual fuel is that if you run out of propane, you can run it by siphoning some gas out of your car. Fill your car up early. Bottom line, make sure the generator is run outdoors. So you might want to, you know, put a big giant eye bolt into a sidewalk or foundation or something and chain your gas generator down. There's been many cases of gas generator or generators in general being stolen by people that didn't plan ahead. So chain it down. And, oh yeah, if you run your generator for any extended period, you should change the oil after you're done.
Supply chain attacks and securing open source software is a big undertaking. We've seen the impact when you don't pay attention to them. Well, according to the ZDNet article, there may be some legislation that looks to help battle some of the issues in a more standardized way. Now, the Bipartisan Securing Open Source Software Act is targeted at ensuring that the U.S. government anticipates and mitigates security vulnerabilities in open source software. Now, the purpose is that it actually proposes that the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, or CISA, must help, quote, ensure that open source software is used safely and securely by the federal government, critical infrastructure, and others. The proposed bill comes after the Log4j security issue blew up in 2021 that we're still actually seeing floating around in the wild. Now, what the bill does is attempts to move open source from the realm of policy and regulation decisions into federal law. Now, this bill will direct the CISA to develop a risk framework to evaluate how open source code is used by the federal government. The CISA would also decide on how the same framework could be used by critical infrastructure owners and operators. According to the Open Source Security Foundation, after they've analyzed the act, the CISA would produce an initial assessment framework for handling open source code risk, incorporating government and industry and open source community frameworks and best practices for software security. But basically, that means the CISA won't try and reinvent any wheels here, and they'll try to use best practices for existing open source security software. Of course, just because a bill reaches Congress doesn't mean it will become a law. Its committee advanced a bill to the Senate floor on September 29th. Now, that's very fast for any type of bill out there. That means that maybe 2023 will actually be the year for securing open source software. We shall see. Well, folks, that does it for the blips. Next up, we have the News Bites. But before we get to the Bites, we have to thank a really great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Cisco, orchestrated by the experts at CDW. Now, the helpful people at CDW understand that hybrid work continues to evolve and that your organization must evolve with it to succeed. And with so many options to collaborate remotely, you need a strong and consistent network to empower your workforce and keep them together. Consider a Cisco hybrid work solution designed and managed by CDW experts to deliver the same quality of network experience to all of your offices, even your satellite ones, connecting your team from pretty much anywhere. Because Cisco networking keeps things flowing smoothly and securely with embedded security, compliance, and multi-factor authentication that protects collaboration among your spread out team. And with real-time visibility into distributed application security, user and service performance, you get a better line of sight in how your network is operating and how better to grow your organization. And Cisco networking levels the playing field, providing access to flexible, high-end collaborative experiences that create an inclusive work environment. When you need to get more out of your technology, Cisco makes hybrid work possible. CDW makes it powerful. Learn more at cdw.com/Cisco. And we thank CDW for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time for the bites. Now, when the Bloomberg Terminal was introduced back in 1982, it changed Wall Street forever. It became a standard in the world of trading and banking. The terminal was a computing marvel out there. It aggregated and correlated all the data from everywhere, anywhere you can possibly imagine, into one single pane. From the market data to global currencies and commodities, real estate to policies and politics, investors and traders had the first time a centralized data platform, which has been real time, to multi-dimensionally analyze data and have visibility into things. Now, we live in the days of information, right? And having a single pane of glass for visibility into all your data for that you need for your job is really something that is, would make it more efficient, right? And make it more helpful for you, right? Let's talk about security. Data analysis is really a critical component there, right? It's for any cybersecurity program, if you think about it. Think about all the data that you have to sift through today, right? From endless amounts of endpoint information or issues to really separate signals and noises. And you really must differentiate between them and from the noise, really, or from legitimate malicious activity that's out there. Now, one thing you have to do is you have to figure out, once you do have malicious activity, how do you prioritize that and take action to mitigate the problems or any of the risks that are out there, and even battle against the bad guys to help your business and your customers. Well, you may ask, well, what about ML and AI, right? They're helping things out there. There's solutions being developed by different technology providers out there. Can they help manage or advance security? Well, problem is, a lot of those solutions are actually developed in isolation. They're built in a bubble. And they're very complex, and they don't have the ability to really scale all to all scenarios that organizations might have. The question is, what if you had a Bloomberg-like terminal for cybersecurity? Well, that's that magic single pane of glass that can gather and correlate all the data for security professionals to help them do their job. That would be amazing, right? Well, I'm going to bring my co-host back in a moment to talk about that, because I want to ask them exactly that. What if they had that, right? Personally, the current approaches for most organizations to actually reduce their business risk and protect critical assets is really isn't working, or it's not really scaling to that complex set of attack vectors that are out there or methods that other people are using. Now, the focus has been on protecting infrastructure, data centers, and devices, but that's by using really a complex set of barriers to really limit access. And in fact, despite the attention to zero trust architectures out there, it seems that the industry is really struggling to turn known issues into other conversations of architecture. The businesses are encouraged to move away from those moats and castles and towards securing access and applications. But really, practitioners out there still tend to focus on building fences around the most critical assets instead of securing the assets themselves. I don't have to tell you that data is really arguably the enterprise's most important asset out there. Data breaches exposed 21 billion records just in 2021. That's why cyber criminals tend to target it and governments around the world regulate it. As the enterprise transitions to the cloud, this shifts dramatically and increases the threat service of any organizations, and much of that activity is outside the visibility of security terms. Now, according to Gartner 2022, the Gartner predicts Consolidated security platforms are the future. That's right. Vendors are increasingly divided into platform and portfolio camps, with the former integrating tools to make a whole that's greater than the sum of its parts, and the latter package it products with a little integration. Now, technology consolidation is not limited to one technology area, even to a closely related set of technologies. These consolidations are happening in parallel across many security areas. I want to bring my co-host back in and throw the question out there. What if we did have a Bloomberg-like terminal security professionals? What do you think, Curtis?
Well, you know, this is something that we talk about with a number of vendors. And on the one hand, you're right. It is the platonic ideal for the data presentation in security. Everyone would love to have one pane of glass that would talk about things. The real problem is twofold. The first is who provides that pane of glass? And the answer is that whoever it is has a remarkable amount of control over the budget and the operation of the security center. Now, there are some companies out there who are logical candidates. Splunk is one. But even Splunk will, tell you that they don't really present themselves as that sole single pane of glass for security. The other big question is single pane of glass for whom? You know, do the first level, you know, the tier one and tier two analysts need the same single pane of glass that the CISO gets? And the answer is not really. You know, each role within the organization, within the security organization, is going to be getting a separate set of information that is perfect for their role. The fact is that the Bloomberg terminal is a great tool for a particular role. I mean, it's designed for the trader. And we can have single panes of glass for the tier one analyst, for the tier two analyst. We can even have a single pane of glass for the CISO. What we aren't going to have, I think, is the single universal pane of glass that prevents the kind of alert fatigue that people are worried about being a serious issue for analysts, because there's just too much data. Cybersecurity in the modern enterprise is too complex an issue, even with the necessary assistance of AI and machine learning. It's a glorious concept. I would love it. And so would lots of other people. But I don't know of anyone who thinks that it's a realistic possibility for any time within the next half decade or so.
Good point. Now, Chibert, I want to throw this to you because you've talked about SIEM in the past. A lot of organizations are kind of moving to this model to help them with things. Is this just a facade for them?
I actually think the issue is quite a bit more basic. It's human nature. I've been part of several IETF committees and one IEEE committee, and getting people representing different points of view or different product lines is part of a standard, because that's what it's going to require. There's going to be required some standards to get a single pane of glass for just about anything. Now, in the case of Bloomberg, they were the big dog on the block, and they could go and force that issue. In the case of security, we've got way too many people in the game that have way too many different issues, and
aspects that they want to support, and their product line. You know, they want to sell their product line. And so getting a single pane of glass, I think, is a wonderful thing. I think it's a great goal in life. But we're going to have an awful lot of battles in the standards committee before something like this actually happens. It's great. I've seen the Bloomberg terminals. I think they are spectacular. I've dreamed about it in the security or the network world, NOC or SOC. I just don't think we're going to get one anytime soon because human nature. Bummer.
Agreed. Yeah, I think there's a lot of solutions out there that get you only so far. And I think Curtis touched on them a little bit. Obviously, there's these whole security information event management solutions. There's log event managing. There's tools like Splunk. And they're kind of like universal ways to manage some of the data that's coming in. But that doesn't give you the full view of all your assets. I know the IoT devices, the number of IoT devices that are putting on the networks today, there's really no way to manage, or a good way really, to really manage all the data and logging access and everything that's coming from them. And so security organizations really need to bottle down or tighten down their efforts here and find better ways to aggregate and analyze the data. And again, single panes of glass are usually a customized view, again, of managing alerts and developing automation along the way to be very specific for you. So it should be interesting to see how things evolve over the next coming years. In the case of single panes of glass, I really don't think that there is a one way to do this. Unfortunately, it's not as structured as markets that are out there today for things like Bloomberg terminals. But we will have to see. We'll have to see if there's some platforms that are built to help standardize it. Well, folks, that does it for the Bytes. Next up, we have our guest drops of knowledge on the Twilight Riot. But before we get to our guest, we do have to thank another great sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Compiler, an original podcast from Red Hat devoted to simplifying tech topics and providing insight for a new generation of IT professionals. Hosted by Angela Andrews and Brent Simino, Compiler composes the gap between those who are new to technology and those behind the inventions and services shaping our world. Compiler brings together stories and perspectives from the industry and simplifies its language, culture, and movements in a way that's fun, informative, and guilt-free. You want to stay on top of tech without the time spent? Well, an original podcast from Red Hat, Compiler presents perspectives, topics, and insights from the tech industry free of jargon and judgment. They want to discover where technology is headed beyond the headlines, right? And create a place where new IT professionals learn, grow, and thrive. Now, Compiler helps people break through barriers and challenges, turning code into community at all levels of the enterprise. In fact, in one episode, they cover the great stack debate. That's right. The software stack is like an onion or a sheet cake or a lasagna. Or is it? It's often described as having layers that sit on top of each other. The reality is much more complicated, and learning about it can help any tech career. Now, the Great Stack Debate is the first episode in Compiler's series on the software stack. They call it Stack Unstuck. They explore each layer of the stack and what's like to work on them and how they come together in a whole application. There's actually another episode covers Are We As Productive As We Think? Great episode. The pressure is to balance productivity with passion projects, personal responsibilities, or just with the need to rest is challenged. Well, their team actually spoke with tech-minded creators in the productivity space on how to achieve full focus and how to make time for work, relaxation, and creativity. Now, personally, I found each episode of Compiler to be super relevant to my job and to several current events happening in the industry. Just talk about the productivity one. There is work overload and productivity paranoia. That's right. We've heard it from many sources. Their episode on productivity walks you through the pitfalls and the things you experience but don't think about when it comes to working impacting our lives. So definitely check that out. That episode's a great one. Learn more at Compiler at red.ht/twit. That's red.ht/twit. Listen to Compiler in your favorite podcast player. We also include a link in show notes for today. Many thanks to Compiler for their support of This Week in Enterprise Tech. Well, folks, it's now time to bring in the guest to drop some knowledge on the Twiat Riot. Today we have Sam Curran. He's Deputy CTO of Indicio. Welcome to the show, Sam.
Glad to be here.
So before we get into the interesting topic of decentralized identity, because it's a really great topic, and we would love to actually broaden it a little bit more from our past episodes, we have a large spectrum of audiences who have different levels of experience. A lot of them like to hear people's origin stories and their journeys through tech. Can you take us through your journey through tech and what brought you to Indicio?
I can. So I've been a nerd for a long time, but my entry into the identity space came mostly as a result of a conference called the Internet Identity Workshop. And I first went to that conference as a result of my grad advisor who helped run it. And so I was semi-required to go. But then kept going even after I graduated and on. And in that community has been really powerful. It's a conference that meets every 6 months, and in the everything from OpenID to OAuth style conversations happen there. Lots of decentralized identity conversations and verifiable credentials are always a topic. But that community is really what got me into doing this decentralized identity stuff.
Fantastic. We know about many identity providers out there, and when you know you log in, you know your identity then is authenticated by similarly the same company that's out there. Now, I dare to mention Facebook or Meta identities out there today. The site might take a Facebook login, and then they really know everything about you, and then they authenticate you, and they kind of basically a centralized way of doing it. Now, we've heard a lot about the concept of decentralized identity. Can you maybe take us through what is it and really what the advantages of it is?
So decentralized identity is sort of best described in contrast to federated identity, which is kind of the world what we work on mostly today, where you have these organizations where you have an identity and you have other parties that decide to rely on those main parties. So this is the login with GitHub, login with Facebook, you know, right. Those varieties. And in this case, the trust in your identity comes from who you asked, meaning the information that was passed directly through one of those federated identity providers, rather than coming directly through the user themselves. And so the main concept of decentralized identity is that you have a core set of technologies that allow for the identity information to be passed along with the person who's authenticating, but still with that trust enabled. And that's done with verifiable credentials primarily, and it allows you to verify the information from an authority without having to actually communicate with that authority directly in any way. And that's the basic idea that allows decentralized identity to work.
You know, it goes along with the normal concept of like personal identity today, where you walk up to somebody and you can show them some piece of identification and they understand who you are. And obviously it follows a similar concept. How does that happen in the digital sense, though?
Well, so this is a really good conversation, right? Is that most of the we talk about online identity, but let's go to like cards in your wallet, right? I have a driver's license as the classic example, and it's good for a number of reasons. If I want to go into a bar, they look at my driver's license to see if I'm old enough to be served alcohol, right? And so that's a maybe an unintended use of my driver's license. The state issued it to me to be able to keep track of who's authorized to drive a vehicle, but it gets used for lots of other cases. Proof of address is one of them. Certainly, I can use it when I go to the airport. And so there's all these sort of side effect use cases of identity, and that's not a bug. That's actually a feature. And federated identity doesn't really allow that today. It doesn't allow me to present the data that I might have from a variety of online, you know, authorities or providers and present it sort of anywhere that I wish for whatever purpose. And so one of the side effects of decentralized identity is that if I am issued a credential that has these verified claims in it, then I can go and present it to somebody else without the issuer actually knowing or being involved. And that actually promotes a wide variety of identity-based use cases that aren't really supported using the online identity models that we have.
Now, we hear a lot about decentralized identity, how it relates to the Web 3.0 concepts that are out there. How is this kind of relating? Is it used blockchain technology?
So it can It doesn't have to. This is a large area of contention. So blockchains turn out to be really great for high available immutable data that you know that everyone can refer to. There's often consensus mechanisms which makes them attack resistant. And so the short answer is no, you don't have to use a blockchain, but you need to be ready to solve all the problems that a blockchain does if you want a robust system to be built on it. So underneath verifiable credentials are usually DIDs, decentralized identifiers. That was a standard recently ratified by the W3C. And not all DID methods have a ledger underneath of them, but many do, specifically because of the advantages that ledgers give you. But no, not technically required.
Interesting. So, you know, we hear a lot about, we've had a lot of, you know, identity and, you know, experts on the show, and they've talked a little bit about FIDO and the technologies that go along with that. How is it different? Maybe how does it complement decentralized identities?
So FIDO is primarily the idea that rather than using something like a username and a password, that you're going to prove key ownership. And you do that by typically signing a challenge. And often that's a hardware device or an app on your phone that helps you to do that. Decentralized identity takes that concept a little further in the sense that not only are you proving key ownership, but you can actually then communicate based on your decentralized identifier, your DID, and actually interact with other folks as well. So it's a similar concept, but advanced further in a way that I think is really powerful for the internet. I mean, this probably come up on the show before. You don't, the internet was created without an identity layer primarily because all the people that were running it knew each other originally. And so, as that expanded, we kind of have never really gotten there. The closest thing we have today as an identity layer is email addresses because you can both prove access to them and they're a method of communication. And so FIDO does the prove who you are or that you are in possession of the same hardware security token that you were last time, but doesn't really solve the communication aspect. And so decentralized identity ventures further into that road to for both communication and for portable trust and verifiable credentials. So it's similar ideas at the start, but it takes it a little further on purpose.
Right. So decentralization and democratizes data and access. It sounds great for individuals, but what is really the real advantage for organizations? Like what's the means for them to move to it?
So a huge example that's often overlooked is decreased integration costs. And I'll give you an example that we as a company have worked with. We did a pilot project with the island of Aruba and the health department of New York State. This was mid-pandemic. There was a project already going on that CETA was helping with to eliminate lines in airports when you arrive at a destination. But the pandemic showed up, and so the efforts pivoted to focus on the pandemic. And as part of that, they wanted to know the island wanted to know that you had a particular test, that you were either vaccinated or you had a negative COVID test. And they didn't directly have a relationship, of course, with all the health departments that could exist in the U.S. And so the technology that we use, verifiable credentials, of course, the subject was issued a verifiable credential of their test results and could then present them when they arrived in Aruba, or actually in advance of arriving at Aruba as well. And the advantage there was that there's some governance. I'm glossing over a handful of things, but the governance involved meant that Aruba could trust the test results of a health lab that they had never communicated with or heard of before because of the architecture of making this happen. It's a little bit funny, but when you hand trusted data to the holder, and they present it to the party that needs to verify that data, you're kind of sneaker netting trust. We joke about sneaker net. You load something onto in the old days, a floppy disk or a USB thumb drive, and then you walk it to its destination. And in some ways, that's kind of what we're doing with verifiable credentials. Rather than worrying about how the issuer and the verifier, the data authority, and then the person that wants to verify the data, how they communicate, you simply give that data to the user. Of course, it's tamper resistant because of the cryptography, and they just move it to wherever they need to take it with them. And so it solves a lot of integration issues. If you didn't have verifiable credentials, there was likely need to be a new organization created that handled a whole bunch of database integrations and costly systems to run because they need to be highly available. And verifiable credentials allow the same trust properties, but without all of the high infrastructure costs and the and the requirements that are normally involved with the integration of multiple data systems.
Now, one question we always get from organizations out there, obviously they like to hear about all the new technologies and methods out there. They're using, you know, standard IAM structures and setups, you know, with normal OpenID providers and so on. What would it take for an organization, small or large, to move to more decentralized system? What is the kind of the process for them to do that?
So there's a couple of different options that are emerging. One of the ways to issue or verify credentials leans on OpenID Connect directly, such that you can pass a credential over that same existing connection. Microsoft has a product that allows you to issue credentials out of Active Directory, and so that's their sort of foray into offering these sorts of things to enterprises. And there's some new technology as well that's emerging that is different on purpose from the other integrations because of the advantages that it gives you. In the enterprise world, we tend to think that you run stuff, you run something like an API, you host the infrastructure and make that happen. That works well when you're talking with other companies or partners that also host APIs. A decentralized identity offers the potential for people to be peers rather than clients in interactions. And so interactions that are adopting that type of stuff involves a little bit more sort of deeper integration to gain those benefits. But there, you can definitely get started with things like OpenID Connect and other style of other similar styles of interaction that work similar to or alongside the technologies that you have in place today in an enterprise.
So I do want to bring my co-host back in because they're chomping at the bit here to ask some questions. They love this topic. I want to throw it to Kurt first. Kurt?
Thanks, Lou. You know, one of the things that I wanted to ask about, we've seen a lot of attention being given on the identity side to the point at which the identity system and the user come together. So, you know, all of the different factors in authentication, the experience, trying to reduce the friction of the experience, all of this thing. Why do you think it's important to focus on, if you will, the back end of identity? I mean, could not the argument be made that we need to make sure that the front end, that you know, the sharp point of the identity system needs to be perfect before we worry so much about the back end?
I don't think we can perfect the front end without working on some of the back end. Ignoring user experience, of course, is a profound way to fail. And that's not anyone's intention here. But I think we have tried to solve identity at some higher layers, and we still have struggles that that identity hasn't really solved yet. OpenID is great, federated identity is great, but it hasn't really solved some of those fundamental things. And I think we're reaching the limits of what the existing technology can provide for, and so we're having to go deeper to try and reorganize some of this stuff. At the same time, a lot of the stuff we're doing is not new. Ledger technology is newish, but PKI technology is not new. And a lot of what we're doing, even the ledgers are doing, is simply sort of a remix of PKI in an attempt to get PKI to go further than it has before in helping us solve problems. So I think that the reason we're going a little deeper than some of the identity technologies is because we're running into the limits of what we can do with the old models that we had. By having a new model of decentralized identity, we can get past some of those barriers that exist, and then carry that progress forward into the UI that the user experience of end users and those that, particularly those that are not technically educated, in order to help them make good decisions about identity and authentication and the other types of things they need to interact with.
Well,
did I get deep enough for you? Is that?
That was perfect, and I'm going to give you a chance to get deep on another topic that's related, because it seems like one of the things that you're doing here is putting ownership of the identity information, the identity data, with the user. I mean, they're responsible for their, you know, or the data is attached to the user in a significant way, rather than being something that a single organization holds out in a store somewhere.
Yeah. So, instead of ownership, I'm going to use the words control. Not because ownership isn't involved, but it's a deeply complicated subject, particularly in most data actually has multiple owners. But control of the data in this model is directly involves the user. And we feel like that's fundamental to reaching some of the privacy requirements that we have, and also reducing the types of attacks that are possible. When a lot of data is held in one place, that ends up as a natural honeypot. I will mention that verifiable credentials do not require the original source of the data to delete that data in any way, but rather to use verifiable credentials to allow the user, the person, to actually control where it goes. The nice part about a verifiable credential is that the user's involved in the process of presenting that credential, which means that the consent is actually built into the architecture, as opposed to being something that we sort of tack on afterwards. A lot of health information exchanges, for example, today have a lot of data about users, and they do their own authentication and their own management about who should be allowed to access that based on their roles or position wherever they are. And that's sticky when you get it wrong. And so anytime we can involve the user in a natural process of granting permission or authorization, architecturally speaking, it means that it's harder to foul that up and to get it wrong. And so a lot of companies are turning to decentralized identity to solve legislative issues, whether it be GDPR or CCPA or the other ones coming down the pike. It's a lot easier to prove that the users are consenting to the types of information flows that you're using if they are literally architecturally a part of how the information gets to from party A to party B. So it solves a lot of issues there for regulatory compliance in particular.
Well, speaking of regulatory compliance, let me ask the big one. Obviously, something like GDPR is heavily concerned with the information around the individual, who controls it, where it's stored, all of this. And on the one hand, it sounds like your system would work very well within GDPR because it addresses some of the sort of foundational issues of who owns and controls the data. On the other hand, I know that GDPR is fairly prescriptive in a number of ways and prescribes things that fit with some other assumptions about how data is stored. So is this an issue that you're having with GDPR, or does your fitting within the core concepts and the core direction of GDPR make it easier to meet all of the prescriptive issues?
So the main question that always gets brought up is that we're interacting with a ledger, and ledgers don't delete things. And so the first thing that I'll mention is that while we most of our solutions use a ledger, that's really uninteresting. The only thing that ends up on a ledger is a public key, an identifier, and often an endpoint. And so there's not actually any PII that goes on the ledger, personally identifiable information. That goes on a ledger on purpose. All of that personal information is actually transferred party to party directly, and so that there's not a permanent record, of course, even hashed or encrypted, that ends up on a ledger, and that's pretty important. GDPR is not really a problem because it was written in such a way that allows us. It took a while for the ledger world to sort of understand how it would apply, but it turns out to be okay. There are some future legislative efforts that we're paying more attention to. Europe is working on eIDAS2, which is the second version of their digital identity framework that they're promoting, and there's definitely some legislative decisions that don't really favor the growth of the right technologies, and this is hard. I understand when legislators want to make things better, but it's really difficult, particularly with rapidly moving technology, to legislate things that only do good and don't do bad. I mean, this is a little bit of a squirrel, but the USB-C regulation that Europe has decided on, I don't think is actually very good, not because I don't like USB-C, but because I worry that it will stifle innovation of a better plug design. And to back apply that to decentralized identity, I think that if you make the wrong legislative decisions, there can be long-term consequences to the development of this technology. most computer professionals are not necessarily very current on things like verifiable credentials because they just haven't run into it yet, mostly. And so to expect legislators to make nuanced decisions about what requirements should be or should not be in legislative frameworks can often be really difficult. Decentralized identity was created and on the time frame such that the GDPR didn't really consider it in the creation of that legislation. And so we're lucky that there's not a real conflict there, but we can't expect that to happen every time something like this comes along. So part of being involved in identity is trying to communicate and guide governments as much as you can into either adopting or at the very worst, not harming the development of this privacy preserving technology.
My turn. Let's go back to the example of the driver's license. I've worked in the federal government a lot, and you would not believe how many fake driver's licenses I've actually seen. One of the great wishes in law enforcement has always been a way to rapidly and easily validate that a driver's license is real. Can we use blockchain?
We can't. So I'm gonna rephrase your plea here. Can we use decentralized identity? Blockchain is sometimes involved, and the answer absolutely is yes. The government already has verified information on you. That's what they're using to like print a driver's license. Cryptography is a lot harder to break than to create a fake looking replica of a driver's license. Let's not even get into like COVID vaccination certificates, but even a driver's license, you know, it's not that hard to fake an approximation, but cryptography either checks out or doesn't check out. And that's one of the advantages of it. And so, we can definitely get to that point. There's two types of trust that are required to really get a driver's license the way you're describing. One type of trust is cryptographic trust. You're making sure that it has not been tampered with since it has been signed by a particular key. The second type is a governance trust, is that just because it's been signed by a key doesn't mean it's been signed by the right key or the right set of keys. And so there needs to be the development of governance systems that allow police officers or even regular individuals to be able to validate that a driver's license is in fact real. And so that is a lot more of the organizational or logistical side of PKI than the actual cryptographic side. How do we know that this driver's license was issued by the state you live in instead of like Joe down the street? Right, because Joe can also make up a key and create that, create a verifiable credential and sign it properly, but it doesn't matter because no one cares what Joe thinks or the fact that Joe is issuing a driver's license. And so that we've got a reasonable handle on the cryptographic trust side of things on how to make this work. The governance side is still developing. We're actively involved in that. The Aruba example that I gave was a huge leap forward in demonstrating that type of decentralized ecosystem governance. But that type of architecture that allows existing authorities to be recognized for the information that they should be trusted for is a really important area of advancement that I expect to see a lot of movement in within the next year.
Okay, so my next question is, I'm going to ask let's go into your crystal ball. Apple seems to think that they're going to try and backdoor in an identity dongle with their Apple Cash system. What do you think? Do you think they're on the right track, or do you think Apple's just trying to get more Apple hardware out?
Apple does a good job serving Apple. I think it's a mistake to assume that the decisions that Apple makes are really for the large benefit of humanity as a whole. And so there's definitely a lot of concern about that. In fact, one of the efforts that is very, very new is called the Open Wallet Foundation that's being formed at the Linux Foundation. And the motivation there is to try and prevent the further calcifying of mobile vendor wallets as being the only wallets that people actually use on a device. I don't know how successful that effort's going to be. I am optimistic about it. But I think that, but I think there's a lot of attention in how we guide or influence those mobile platforms to do the right thing. And I have two opinions here. One is it would be great if they did the right thing and they actually joined and worked with a larger community of experienced professionals that know how to do this stuff and got on board with that. On the other hand, I don't think they can really kill it unless they decide that they're not going to allow any apps on their mobile platform that that perform wallet-like functionality. Because there's already a whole bunch of apps out here that that allow you to interact with verifiable credentials. And so unless they decide to kill those, I don't actually think that they can impede our progress very much. I think they could accelerate it if they chose to get involved and to do things in a healthy way. But I don't think they can actually impede its development in particular very much. They could be annoying about it, but I think ultimately, that we're going to end up with a much better solution, in the future because of that. So I hope, you know, development never, happens quite as fast as you hope it will. But I hope that, that we can keep moving, at a pace that, that the mobile vendors are going to have to pay attention at some point, and then get involved and hopefully they make good decisions when they do so. That was a little bit of a squishy answer to your question. Hopefully that was what you're looking for.
Fantastic. Well, unfortunately, time flies when you're having fun. The show went really fast. Sam, thank you so much for being here. Since we're running a little low on time, we do want to give you a chance to tell the folks home where they can find out more information about Indicio and maybe even decentralized identities.
So I do work for Indicio. Indicio.tech is the URI there that will help you find out more. We are a company that strives to help people with identity problems. And so we lean heavily on open source. We contribute to the related projects in the ecosystem, lots of them based at Hyperledger. We're involved at working groups all over the place with different organizations. And so I have two general pleas. If you are interested as a company, we'd be happy to, as Indicio, to talk to you about this. And even if you're not interested in using us as a vendor, and you're interested in this, then please get involved with the community efforts that exist. The Decentralized Identity Foundation is one of those groups. The Hyperledger Indian Aries projects are very focused on this. And the W3C Community Credentials Group is another area where lots is done about this. If speaking about identity for three action-packed days where you set the agenda is in your interest, in the middle of November, the Internet Identity Workshop is an excellent place to attend. In any of those community events, you'll meet lots of people. You can get involved and to help further the work along. We likely need your expertise and perspective, and that will help the whole thing be better. So whether we can serve you as a consulting company or one of the products that we have will help accelerate your efforts, that's great. If not, we'd love you to get involved in the open source community. We're a big believer and a big supporter of it. So thanks, and I hope to see all of you involved.
Well, folks, you've done it again. You sat through another hour of the Best Thing Enterprise and IT podcast in the universe. So definitely tune your podcatcher to Twyatt. I want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to my co-host, starting with our own Mr. Curtis Franklin. Curtis, what's going on for you in the coming weeks? Where can people find you?
Well, this week they could have found me doing hurricane prep with any luck at all. They won't be able to find me doing that next week. Instead, they'll find me back hard at work at Dark Reading and Omdia, where I'm working on a number of projects. I'll be publishing on Dark Reading. Follow me on Twitter at KG4GWA. Follow me on LinkedIn. I'm Curtis_Franklin. And if you're going to be in Central Florida in the early part of November, feel free to follow me all the way to the Orlando Maker Faire. We're getting ready for that. It is one of the largest maker fairs around, and certainly the largest in North America that is produced entirely by volunteers. And I will be one of those volunteers. I'll look forward to seeing folks at one of the world's great show and tell experiences.
Thank you, Curtis. Looking forward to it. Well, we also have to thank our very own Mr. Brian Chi. Chibert, what's going on for you in the coming week? Where can people find you?
I am cleaning up. There's an awful lot of stuff to clean up, not the least of which is next big task is drying and folding and taking down the ballistic nylon storm shutters, which they worked really well, but you know, maybe, just maybe, I can get a hold of the company and get them to learn how to measure. Anyway, back to the show. we'd love to hear from you. And on Twitter, I am ADVNETLAB, Advanced Net Lab, holdover from the days of working at the University of Hawaii. People keep asking, where did Chibert come from? And that came from my students. The Advanced Network Computing Laboratory, we had a naming theme of using Dilbert names. And my student, Mike Kanata, decided, since we had Dilbert, Catbert, Ratbert, and so forth, that I had to be Chibert. Anyway, that'll answer your curiosity. But my curiosity is, I would love to hear show ideas from you folks. Now, we do have an awful lot of shows booked, but we have wiggle room, and I try to go by themes. Identity is definitely one of the themes. SaaS, you name it. We have lots of different themes that we try to fill, and a lot of the bookings are fit into those themes that you suggest. So we'd like to hear from you. The other way of hearing from you is you can throw email at me. My email is Chibert, Cheebert, at twit.tv. You're also welcome to send email to Twyatt at twit.tv, and that'll hit all the hosts. We'd love to hear from you, even if, you know, it's in your native language. Just beware, I'll be using a machine translator. But we've had some amazing questions from folks in France, Germany, Africa. I actually still correspond with some folks that live in Joburg, South Africa. And we can have some fun bouncing some ideas back and forth. So we'd love to hear from you and love to hear show ideas. Just, you know, to the folks in the Carolinas that are getting the Ian, be careful, be safe.
Thank you, Chibert. Well, we also have to thank you as well. You're the person who drops in each and every week to get your enterprise and IT goodness to listen to our show, and we want to make it easy for you to watch and listen and catch up on your IT and enterprise news. So go to our show page right now, twit.tv/Twyatt. Amazing page there. There you'll find all the amazing back episodes, the show notes, co-host information, guest information, of course, all the links of the stories that we do during the show. But more importantly there, next to those videos, you'll get those helpful subscribe and download links. Support the show by getting your audio version or your video version of your choice and listen on any one of your devices or any one of your podcast applications, because we're on all of them. So definitely subscribe and support the show. But you've probably also heard of our Club Twit as well. It's a really great members only ad-free podcast service with a bonus Twit Plus feed that you can't get anywhere else. It's only $7 a month, and you can get a lot of great things with Club Twit. In fact, one of them is the exclusive access to the members only Discord server. We have a lot of great channels in there. You can chat with hosts and producers. You can have separate discussions and all the amazing channels in there. Plus, they also have special events. That's right. So check that out. Lots of fun discussions and channels. So join Club Twit and be part of the movement. Go to twit.tv/Club Twit for more information. Now, Club Twit also offers corporate group plans as well. It's a great way for your giving your team access to our ad-free tech podcasts. Plans start with 5 members at a discounted rate of $6 each per month, and you can add as many members as you like. And this is really a great way for your IT departments, your developers, your tech teams, your customer service people to stay up top of all of our, or have access to all of our podcasts. So definitely have them join as well. Just like regular memberships, they can join the Twit Discord server and get that Twit Plus bonus feed as well. So twit.tv/Club Twit. Now, after you subscribe, you can impress your family members, your coworkers, your friends with the gift of Twyatt, because we talk a lot about fun tech topics on here, and I guarantee they will find it fun and interesting as well. So definitely have them run out there right now and subscribe and be part of the fun. But speaking of being part of the fun, we also do this show live. That's right, 1:30 p.m. Pacific on Fridays, and we have a live stream. If you go to live.twit.tv, there all the streams are there. You can choose from the ones that are lowest latency for you, and you can watch the show. You can watch how the pizza's made, behind the scenes, all the banter, all the fun we have here on Twit, live on the stream. Plus, if you're going to watch it live, you might as well join our chat room as well. It's irc.twit.tv, the infamous chat room. And you have all the reoccurring characters in there, plus all some of the new characters that come in and join us during the show, ask some questions, sometimes actually direct the show in different vectors. So definitely be in there and be part of the show, be part of the conversation at irc.twit.tv. And definitely hit me up during the week or in the weekend at twitter.com/LouMM. There I post all my enterprise tidbits. I get a ton of great DMs from people about show titles and show options and topics. We talk a lot about fun tech topics. So definitely hit me up there on LinkedIn, wherever you reside, wherever you have, you post your stuff, definitely hit me up there. Plus, if you want to know what I do during my normal work week at Microsoft, definitely check out developers.microsoft.com/office. There we post all the amazing and latest and greatest ways for you to customize your office experience, generate macros, whatever you want to do with your office installation or your servers to make it more productive for you, make it more useful and automated for you. So definitely check out all the latest and greatest ways for you to do that there. I also want to thank everyone who makes this show possible, especially to Leo and Lisa. They continue to support us each and every week. We couldn't do this week in Enterprise Tech without them. So thank you for all their support. Of course, all the staff and engineers at Twit, I want to thank them as well. Of course, I want to thank Mr. Brian Chi one more time. He's not only our co-host, but he's also our tireless producer. He has all the show bookings and the plannings for the show, and we really couldn't do it without him. So thank you, Chibert, for all your support. And of course, before we sign out, we have to thank our editor for today. Of course, he's going to make us look good behind the scenes after the fact. So thank you for all your support. And of course, cutting out all my mistakes. And of course, I want to thank our TD for today, the talented Mr. Ant Pruitt. He does an amazing show called Hands-On Photography, which I religiously watch each and every week. I learn new things about cameras. In fact, I'm using a new settings from one of Ant's episodes right now on my stream here. So definitely to Ant, thanks to Ant for that. Ant, what's going on this week in Hands-On Photography?
Well, sir, this week, thank you very much for allowing me to plug the show. But this week I sat down with Alexis Charisma. He's a Bay Area photographer here, but he does a lot of work in L.A. and New York, working with brands and working with all the celebrities. And it's just a really cool guy. Great story. Great energy. Definitely go check that one out. Twit.tv/hop. That's twit.tv/HOP.
Thank you, sir. We look forward to seeing you next week. And until next time, I'm Louis Maresca, just reminding you, if you want to know what's going on in the enterprise, just keep quiet.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.